From NPR News in Washington, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. This week, we're celebrating NPR's 50th anniversary, kicking off a series we're calling We Hold These Truths, to examine what's working and what's not in American democracy. And one of the underpinnings of democracy, without question, is property ownership. You see, there was a time when owning property was required simply to participate in this democracy. Yet we began as a nation that considered Black people to be property, to be three-fifths of a person.
There's also an assumption in this country that owning a home is the best way to build intergenerational wealth. But more than a century and a half after the end of slavery, property ownership eludes Black Americans more than any other racial group. In fact, the gap between white and Black home ownership is bigger today than it was in 1960, when race-based discrimination in the U.S. was still legal.
So this week, we're going to look at the structural forces, both from the government and the real estate industry, that have denied Black Americans a fair shot at the American dream of home ownership. One person who has spent many years thinking and writing about this is Kiyenga Yamada Taylor. She wrote the book Race for Profit, a finalist for the 2020 Pulitzer Prize in History, and she's going to help us open our series. We began our conversation discussing why homes owned by Black Americans don't accrue value the same way that white-owned homes do.
The market is a reflection of social attitudes in our society. I think sometimes we are led to believe that the market is this neutral space where supply and demand are the only thing that dictate how it functions.
Yeah.
And that's simply not true. The market is a reflection of that which we hold to be valuable, that which we see as desirable, that which we see as undesirable. And it's impossible to measure that without factoring in race in the United States.
And there has been a long-standing practice in real estate to connect race with the perception of risk, meaning it's considered riskier to loan to Black homebuyers. Can you talk about how the government helped perpetuate this perception through redlining?
So redlining is a practice that developed out of public policy in the 1930s. And essentially, the federal government, in response to the Great Depression, where millions of people were losing their homes and banks were no longer willing to lend money, created programs to help people refinance their homes. So the federal government were considering, what is a good neighborhood for us to refinance home loans of people in that community? And later, what is a good area for us to guarantee a home loan? And so you have the federal government acting as an insurance agency. And it meant that they created color-coded maps that originate in the 1930s. The most prized areas on these maps were blue, green, yellow, and then red, signified that an area had very old and dilapidated buildings. It was unlikely that value would accrue in these properties. And it also was to signify what kinds of people were moving into those areas, whether they were African-American immigrants or other undesirable populations. And this desire was built around the notion that some people are good for property values and some people are bad for property values. And this helped to really dictate where other business would invest. And this is really the moment where disinvestment and all of the consequences of that are really etched in policy. And we continue to see the reverberation of those public policy decisions made in the 1930s today.
Exactly. Consequences have flowed from those decisions. This perception that it's a bigger risk to loan to Black people. I mean, you have written about how that ends up becoming kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy for Black homeowners. Evidence we can see today.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It does become a self-fulfilling prophecy where if the federal government has refused to back mortgages in these areas, which signals to other businesses not to participate economically in these areas, then it means that there is greater levels of dilapidation and deterioration in the housing, because it's not just the big mortgage loans that Black people are excluded from, but the Federal Housing Administration was also giving white homeowners small maintenance repair loans so that they could keep up with maintenance issues with their homes. So African Americans and other people living in the redlined grade D areas on these residential maps are excluded from small repair loans as well. And so it means that the housing is in greater distress, is in greater disrepair. The lack of investment means there are fewer jobs. So these neighborhoods look depressed, but people coming through the neighborhood don't understand the public policy decisions that have been made that have created these conditions. Yeah. All they see are African Americans are living in these neighborhoods. The buildings are overcrowded, they're in disrepair. And so that becomes conflated with race.
Right. We've been talking up until now about financial hurdles facing Black Americans who want to accrue property wealth and the disinvestment that flows from that. But there have been other kinds of barriers blocking Black people in this country from owning homes. Let's talk about racially restrictive covenants. Briefly explain what those were.
So when property is sold, it's a rider included in the deed that says this property can only be sold to other white people. And it would list who would be excluded from sale. Sometimes it was Jewish people, different immigrant or ethnic groups, but primarily it was a tool to exclude sale from African Americans. And the reason that covenants became popular is because there was an initial effort by city governments to use what was called racial zoning, where city government could come up with racially designated blocks within a community and say, white people live here, Black people live there. But a 1917 Supreme Court decision said that that was a clear violation of the 14th Amendment. And so the real estate industry shifted to using racially restricted covenants as a way to keep African Americans legally locked out of white communities.
And, you know, even after racially restrictive covenants are deemed unenforceable by the Supreme Court in 1948, and even after redlining gets abolished by the Fair Housing Act in 1968, the imprint of these racist policies and practices remains. So I'm curious, how do you see the government and the private real estate industry working together still to keep Black Americans from owning homes?
Well, this is part of the problem. I mean, you can't have 35, 36 years of legal discrimination and then declare it over and expect that the legacy, the history, and the impact of those policies and practices just wither away overnight. Yeah. They have lasting effects that continue to mark African Americans as irresponsible homeowners, neighbors. It is used to designate African Americans as quote unquote subprime. It helps to constitute Black people as credit risks. And all of these factor into the differential treatment of African Americans in the housing market. And so this is an underlying explanation for what I describe as predatory inclusion, which is to say that no longer are African Americans being excluded from the market. Now they are being included. But this entire history of exclusion creates the basis upon which Black people are now included, but on different terms, with subprime loans, for example, paying higher interest rates, paying more fees because of the cumulative impacts of these policies and practices over these several decades, reconstituted their neighborhoods as risky, reconstituted them themselves as credit risks. And with risk come the legal pretext for treating Black consumers differently. So you can be included, but you have to pay an additional price to do so.
Kiyanga Yamada Taylor is a professor at Princeton University and author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership. Thank you very much for lending us your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to go back in time now and visit a neighborhood in Los Angeles that no longer exists. The story of Sugar Hill brings to life many of these ideas we just talked about: segregation, racist covenants, and who has the right to live where. Here's producer Janaki Mehta.
This is what Ra and Van Nickerson's childhood home sounds like today.
Where the freeway is now.
Right here, this overpass?
Yeah, that's where Berkeley Square was.
What she's pointing to, right there where that sign says, quarter next three exit. Lift it up, our house is right about there.
And their house is now where the Santa Monica Freeway is. Van was just 3 years old. His sister Ra was four when their family moved here almost 70 years ago. They lived in a charming little pocket of central Los Angeles called Berkeley Square.
The street was very wide. We had the old style lanterns. There were all kinds of like craftsman houses, 5, 6, 7 bedrooms.
So these were big houses.
Very big. And we sold lemonade at the east end of Berkeley Square.
And we got our wagon and we'd go up and down the street selling lemonades.
Right.
Berkeley Square was part of a larger neighborhood called Sugar Hill, which was named after a wealthy Black section in Harlem. By the 1940s, Sugar Hill was home to some of the most prominent figures of Black Los Angeles. Doctors, entrepreneurs, oil barons, even Hollywood stars like Gone with the Wind's Hattie McDaniel. On screen, she may have played a housekeeper or an enslaved person, but here in Sugar Hill, she hosted extravagant soirees in her sprawling mansion where people like Duke Ellington and Ethel Waters would perform.
This thriving community in Sugar Hill existed despite a powerful tool that white residents were using to keep neighborhoods white: the racially restrictive covenant. Ra Nickerson remembers her dad explaining this to her when she was really young.
Well, my father would talk about covenants. As a child, I worked with him in his real estate business. And covenants were alive and thriving, you know? He would show me documents, and he would show how the covenants were worded. No Blacks, no Jews, just blatant hate. And it was everywhere.
Everywhere in the U.S., including in Sugar Hill. These covenants were basically agreements written into property deeds that made homeowners promise never to sell to African Americans or other minority groups. In 1940, 80% of the properties in Los Angeles had these restrictions attached to them.
And courts helped enforce these rules. But some white homeowners willingly violated these covenants to sell to Black buyers, in part because those buyers were willing to pay more since there was less property available to them.
The first known Black person to buy a home in Sugar Hill was Norman O. Houston. He knew very well at the time that he was defying a covenant attached to the house he bought in 1938. Here's Ivan Houston, his grandson.
He recognized things that were unfair, and he felt he was as equal as anybody and nothing should hold him back. So he kept pushing as far as he could push, but legally.
But as more African Americans moved into Sugar Hill, one white homeowners association didn't like what was happening. So they sued their Black neighbors for violating these racially restrictive covenants. Hattie McDaniel, Norman Houston, and dozens of other Black families fought back with their own Black Homeowners Association.
They created the organization called the West Adams Heights Protective Association. Before it was called Sugar Hill, it was the West Adams Heights District.
Ivan Houston still has this old notebook that belonged to the association.
Okay, let's see. The meeting of the West Adams
Heights. The pages are all browned with age. The handwriting is in this tidy cursive.
That's the book of the minutes that, you know, Granddad was the president of the group. It has all the minutes of the restrictive covenants, the redlining, and the meetings to start changing the restrictions.
Those meetings to change these restrictions, they went on for years. But then, on December 5th, 1945, the parties entered a courtroom. Legal historian Amina Hassan says that day, you could see wealthy Black Angelenos dressed to the nines.
Hattie McDaniel and hundreds of sympathizers appeared in court in all their finery. This is what a reporter said. The stylish atmosphere in the court was such as to make one wonder if the judge would pour tea during the afternoon recess.
This crowd had shown up not only to see the Hollywood stars, but also to take in the legendary NAACP lawyer, Lauren Miller, who argued their case.
His presentation was electrifying, and the people were waiting for a good show, and I believe they got a good show.
Miller argued that racially restrictive covenants were unconstitutional because they violated the 14th Amendment, which mandates equal protection under the law. And remarkably, that argument worked. Hassan says this victory was about more than simply winning the right to stay in Sugar Hill. It was about giving Black people in Los Angeles access to a better life.
Housing was the crux of it all. It opened those avenues for them to move beyond the one part of Los Angeles designated for Black people. They could have their children in better schools, and they could find jobs in the area. Housing opened the door.
Eventually, the Sugar Hill case in California paved the way for a 1948 Supreme Court case, Shelley v. Kramer, which would ultimately deem racially restrictive covenants unenforceable nationwide. At the time, that victory felt momentous. To Ron Nickerson, it meant maybe the system could be used to help Black people live where they chose.
You don't make waves, but you quietly use the legal system. You quietly talk with your brethren, and you systematically, step by step, but you kept your focus. You knew that it was necessary for Black people to live where they wanted to live.
But it didn't take long for Ra and her brother Van to learn the two of them wouldn't actually be able to live where they wanted to live. A few years after Shelley v. Kramer, rumors began to spread that the government intended to demolish Sugar Hill to make room for a freeway as part of a federal push in the 1950s to modernize America's roadways. Black residents in Sugar Hill banded together again. They headed to the state capitol and lobbied against the freeway project. But this time around, they lost their fight to stay in Sugar Hill. The California Highway Commission unanimously approved a new freeway that would split Sugar Hill in two and plow right through Ra and Van Nickerson's childhood home.
I watched the tractor bulldoze these homes down, and I was still young. We used to go and play in the lot where the freeway was being built. I remember the sand. I remember standing in the sand. I remember when it rained, there were puddles, and we played in the sand puddles across the street where they were building the freeway.
The government seized the Nickerson's home through eminent domain. Now, while the U.S. Constitution requires, quote, just compensation for any property acquired through eminent domain, Ra Nickerson says her family was cheated.
I remember my father telling me about eminent domain and how there was no option to stop this. The valuation for our home was quite low. It was not market value that we were compensated for. And so it was quite an upheaval.
An upheaval that Ra's father said would never have happened if Sugar Hill were a white neighborhood.
He was very, very angry. He felt the city government resented Black people living there. And this is their way of demolishing a very viable community to support racism.
At the time, highway planners used the language of science to justify building freeways through communities of color. That's what Eric Avila says. He's a professor of urban planning at UCLA.
They presented a kind of dizzying array of charts and graphs to insist that this was the most economically efficient route for this particular freeway. They denied any questions of race. They denied any questions of bias.
What they did instead, Avila says, was say that they were targeting so-called blighted communities.
I don't think we know the extent to which Sugar Hill was designated a blighted area because, you know, it was affluent. But in the discourse of urban planning in the mid-20th century in the United States, blight was often synonymous with people of color and with African Americans in particular.
Around the same time the freeway construction through Sugar Hill began, the California Division of Highways proposed another freeway that would cut through Beverly Hills. But when that wealthy white community protested, officials canceled construction. Almost 70 years later, the Nickersons still feel the loss of their childhood home.
It was just sad. I didn't know what to expect because that's all I knew was Berkeley Square. And I really felt very secure in the community. That's all I knew, you know. So I was quite rattled by it all.
She and her brother say after the freeway forced them to leave their childhood home, they never quite experienced the same safety and comfort that Sugar Hill provided.
And we moved over onto Bronson Avenue, and I immediately got to some problems. Most of that neighborhood was white, and a white boy called me a nigger in front of my house, and pardon my vernacular, but I kicked his ass. You know, that was the beginning of the real world for us.
Much of Sugar Hill vanished when the Santa Monica Freeway came through, erasing a black community to connect newly built white suburbs to the city. When freeways carve through communities, property values there decline, which means less money for schools in the area. And for many residents who live along freeways today, toxic pollutants and constant noise are part of everyday life. These consequences have played out in cities all across America, especially in black and brown communities.
Before we parted ways that day, Van and Ron Nickerson closed their eyes and listened to Berkeley Square one more time.
I hear the rumbling of the automobile. You can almost feel it sitting here, shaking the ground. That was non-existent when we were kids. It was quiet.
Very quiet. You can't hear the birds anymore.
As we walked away from the freeway overpass, Ron Nickerson headed to the corner to catch the next bus to Inglewood, where she lives now. And Van got into his car to begin his journey back home to a town more than an hour away. His drive would begin on the Santa Monica Freeway and take him right through the middle of what was once known as Sugar Hill. Around the same time that the Santa Monica Freeway was being built through Ron and Van Nickerson's neighborhood, another story was playing out just south of there in Compton, California. The city was in the midst of transforming from all white to majority black, and that demographic shift was being driven in part by a predatory real estate practice known as blockbusting, a force that exploited black homebuyers in search of the suburban dream. Here's producer Janaki Mehta.
There's this day that's been imprinted on Robert Johnson's mind for the past 60 years.
And I'm looking down the street. I see moving vans, trucks, and everything all down the street.
It's 1961, moving day. Johnson is just 5 years old, and he realizes his family isn't the only one moving into Compton that exact same day. For blocks and blocks, he sees people moving into houses.
And so I thought it was moving day for everybody. Everybody just switch houses. You know, you're a kid, you know?
Another thing he noticed, everyone moving in that day was black, just like his own family. His new next-door neighbor noticed the same thing.
They live a white person with a son.
Juanita Sanchez has lived on this block since the late 1950s, and she says back when she first moved to Compton, almost everyone on her block was white.
Okay. And then over here was a white family with kids and all, but then...
But then, she says most of those white families on this block started leaving.
It happened very quickly?
Yeah.
The white people seem to have left very quickly?
Uh-huh.
How quickly?
Say 2-3 years, everybody was gone.
And then who replaced them?
Black people.
Why do you think white families moved away?
I don't know. They got scared.
This perception that the arrival of black residents was reason to be scared, this is one of the most powerful forces impeding generations of black Americans from building wealth through home ownership. You see, perceptions, including racist perceptions, shape the real estate market. Oftentimes, when a neighborhood turns white, property values go up. And when a neighborhood turns black, property values go down.
This American reality played out starkly in Compton, a city that went from being almost exclusively white to majority black. And one major mechanism that drove the shift was a predatory real estate practice called blockbusting.
Johnson would come to understand only years later how his family, like so many other Black families at the time, were unknowing targets in a scheme that helped a lot of real estate agents make a lot of money.
So they would approach the white homeowners and basically scare them. The Negroes are coming. Look here, you know, you're going to want to sell your home. And what they were doing was they were panic selling.
That is how blockbusting worked. Real estate agents would tell these white homeowners that their houses were losing value by the day. So the homeowners would panic and sell.
Then those agents would turn around and sell those homes at inflated prices to Black buyers who were eager to make a start in better neighborhoods. And all along, state regulators condoned this practice.
So I remember this flyer that was stuck under the door, and it was from a real estate company.
That's Kitty Feldy, who's white. She was in elementary school in Compton during the 1960s when that flyer arrived.
It had one very clear message, and it was, sell now, because you're never going to be able to get the money you want for your house. And they didn't say this, but it was like, they are moving in. They. It was extremely clear that it meant African Americans. And, you know, my folks were really upset. They were like, we are not leaving because, quote unquote, they are moving in here. It was a matter of principle. It was a reflection of their religious beliefs, of their social justice beliefs. They weren't going to do it.
So her parents stayed put, but droves of other white residents abandoned Compton during these years. And Black families, like Robert Johnson's, moved in.
Oh, man, it felt like not just a step up, but a step into another world. It was your typical suburban dream.
To Johnson back then, Compton felt utterly removed from his previous life at Nickerson Gardens, the public housing complex in L.A. where his family used to live. Compton meant his mother, an X-ray technician, and stepfather, an aerospace engineer, could finally buy something of their own.
In the backyard, we had orange tree, a persimmon tree. I didn't know what a persimmon was. I learned over the years because I had to clean them up because they fell off the tree. Same thing with loquats. I didn't know what a loquat was till I got to Compton.
Johnson remembers an idyllic childhood during those first years in Compton, when kids had all kinds of after-school activities. He reminisces about his swim lessons right here in Wilson Park.
Where was the pool?
Right here where the skate park is now.
Johnson says this park used to be fully staffed with adults who would supervise the kids while they played ball games.
And our parents were involved. You know, your father was out there being the coach. The mothers were out there supporting the team, selling hot dogs and stuff like that.
Albert Camarillo, who also grew up in Compton, is now a professor of history at Stanford University.
Compton becomes the promised land. If you worked hard, you have the money to be able to move into Compton.
He says industrial jobs further attracted Black residents to Compton.
The housing stock was relatively new. 3-bedroom, 2-bath, suburban tract homes. The streets were paved and the schools are pretty good.
But while Compton represented social mobility for so many Black Americans, it also came to represent their exploitation. Predatory practices like blockbusting forced families to overpay for homes that would eventually decline in value as more Black residents arrived.
Take Johnson's house, for example. According to census data, the median home price in Compton in 1960 was only $12,800. Johnson's family paid $17,500, and their home was smaller than most in the area. Josh Sides, a professor at California State University Northridge, says those numbers strongly suggest that Johnson's family was a target of blockbusting. And after more Black residents moved in, home prices in Compton languished over the next several generations.
The really evil part of blockbusting, in my view, is that it perpetuated the notion that Black people in your neighborhood diminished value. And because of that perception, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, it became true that a Black person moving to your neighborhood meant your value declined. Because, of course, property values are largely the function of social decisions and social beliefs.
In 1950, 1/5 of 1% of Compton's entire population was non-white. Just 10 years later, the city was 40% Black. And when white people fled Compton, white-owned businesses did too, which was a blow to the city's tax base. And city services suffered.
As those white business owners move out, there's no way to recover from that, because part of the challenge of a small independent city like Compton was that it was so thoroughly reliant on the tax base, not only of its property owners, but also of the business owners.
Not only did that tax base disappear, so did steady manufacturing jobs in South LA. And as unemployment in Compton worsened, Johnson remembers neighbors started having trouble making their home loan payments.
You know, the first time I really noticed it personally was at school, because you're sitting in class and your classmates are gone. They had moved away. And that was my first indication that something was going on.
He also noticed that Wilson Park, where he had all those swim lessons, it no longer had the funds to hire adult supervisors to watch the kids there. Meanwhile, tensions between police and residents ramped up as the crack epidemic took hold in Compton in the 1980s.
People in Compton were put in a very bad position. The legitimate jobs were gone. And then comes this, it's more than a drug, it's almost like a demonic spirit.
All of these factors, escalating crime, police violence, a lower tax base, and rising unemployment, all of that changed the face of Johnson's neighborhood. He recalls the exact moment when he finally resolved to leave the city he had lived in for almost three decades.
One day I'm sitting in front of my house washing my car, and some fool from a block away had got a new rifle and he starts shooting out the streetlights.
Wow.
And I knew that if something had happened to my son, I knew how I would react. So, you know, I raised my son elsewhere.
When Johnson's family left in 1988, they sold their home for $64,000. It was worth less than what they paid in 1961. If you adjust for inflation, that house lost almost 8% of its value over 27 years.
But even though Johnson left Compton, Compton never really left him. He's written a book about the city's history. He's a founding member of the city's historical society. And you can see his face brighten instantly when he spots an old neighbor.
Mr. Scott, how are you? How's your mom doing? Yeah.
People like Robert Johnson left Compton for a better life, but they lost something along the way.
We're going to hear more about what was lost from a man named Billy Ross.
You go elsewhere looking to carve out some economic security, but culturally now you are diluted. And that was a part of what I called Black Flight, you know?
That flight saw Ross and generations of Black Angelenos leave South LA for the promise of a new start to the East in California's Inland Empire. But the opportunity they chased came at an unexpected cost. Producer Janaki Mehta and I traveled to the Inland Empire to begin our next chapter.
When Billy Ross would come visit his cousins in the Inland Empire back in the 1980s, it was mostly desert and vineyards.
I remember, you know, coming out here and none of this existed. This park is like 15 years old. These houses were built like 06, 07, 08.
Ross, who's 45, lives here now, just walking distance from this local park, in a city called Rancho Cucamonga. We stopped in front of some kids playing on a swing set.
What would you say is the character, the identity of the Inland Empire?
It looks and feels safe. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. People especially who jump ship from places like where I came from.
Where Ross came from is Compton, once a majority Black city south of downtown LA. He grew up there in the 80s and early 90s, and memories of Compton still bring up conflicted feelings for him.
It was magical, and it was incredibly challenging. Like, you know, we'd sit on the porch. I'd get my hair braided. Somebody would walk down the street. Man, you coming down the street? Yeah, give me about an hour or so. Let me finish getting my hair braided. That's how I grew up. And that was magical. And it was also messed up, too. It was the kind of environment where I bought my first pistol at 13, 14 years old.
Why? What went through your head at 13, 14 that made you think, I need a pistol?
It was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was dangerous. And it was kind of like the thing to do, too.
This is around the time when the crack epidemic hit. Jobs started leaving Compton and South LA. Police violence against Black people was intensifying. And there was a housing shortage in the city. Owning your own piece just got harder and harder. So a lot of people in Compton began turning their gaze 50 miles east to a region called the Inland Empire. It was exploding with new construction. Ross's relatives would tell him about the huge, gleaming houses there.
When they would describe how they imagined life to be, what is the image they painted for you or for other people who lived in Compton?
I think it was fly. It was supposed to be fly. You know, it's like, what? You guys gonna buy a 5-bedroom house and y'all gonna have a pool? Like, what? That's super fly. You know what I mean? Like, so, and people were willing to commute for that.
They were willing to commute 4 to 5 hours round trip for that. By the early 2000s, so many Black residents from Compton had moved into the Inland Empire, one of its neighborhoods became known as Little Compton. But there were still a lot of people in Compton who insisted the right thing to do was to stay. People like Ross's father.
His philosophy was don't move, improve. And we hear that, you know, we hear that a lot.
What does that
with
mean?
Black folk. It means what it says. In the places where we are, in mass, there is often an incentive to leave, and that's messed up.
Think about how messed up it is, he says, when the place where you grow up, the place you identify with, becomes the place you think you need to flee to have a better life.
Better. That's so complicated, that word, better. We got to leave our communities. You see what I'm saying? Like, you don't have a lot of other groups having to make that decision. Like, you got to leave your community to be okay.
But eventually, leaving his community was the best option. After Ross graduated from college, got married, and was getting ready to have a kid, he and his wife, Tamara, wanted what lots of people would want. Safety, more space, good school districts. And the Inland Empire offered all of that.
Ross zeroed in on a 4-bedroom house with a 3-car garage in Fontana. The whole lot was almost 8,000 square feet, and it would cost $525,000. He met a loan officer who offered him a loan with amazing terms. Minimal down payment, no proof of income or assets, nothing. Just a credit check. That's it.
Was there any part of you at the time when you were looking at the terms of this loan, were you thinking, this is too good to be true?
Maybe. There was this kind of feel that this is a secret and it's being brought to the masses now. That was even part of the pitch. Like, you know, remember this feeling like, oh, yeah, this kind of loan white people use, you know, like, why would you use your own money, you know what I mean, to buy a house?
It was so easy. They told him if he had any problems down the road, he could always refinance. He and Tamara had great credit scores, so they signed their papers, and by June 2006, they moved into their house in Fontana. And immediately, Ross threw himself into the pleasures of suburban life.
The newness of it was cool. This is a 1-story house, and it has space inside and outside. And I could water my own grass like my father did. You know, I had grass.
Life was great in Fontana that first year. Ross's career in real estate was taking off. His wife was climbing the ranks as a prosecutor. They were growing their family.
And then by the fall of 07, all hell broke loose.
The global financial crisis struck. Almost 16% of all the homes in this region went into foreclosure, making the Inland Empire one of the hardest hit places in the entire country. Many homeowners sought help from the Fair Housing Council of Riverside County, where Rose Mays is the executive director. She remembers during this time, the phone would not stop ringing.
And you know when you hear people crying on the telephone, you hear people just begging you, somebody must listen to us.
During all these phone calls, Mays says she noticed a pattern. Most of the foreclosures were happening in very specific zip codes.
92502, 92503, 4, where you find Hispanics and African American. Those are the zip codes.
Where you saw a lot of subprime
loans. Yeah, a lot of subprime loans.
This pattern played out all across the U.S. Black and Latinx borrowers got more high-cost, high-risk mortgages than any other borrowers. Lenders were aggressively trying to sell as many loans as possible, and they targeted some of the most vulnerable people with the riskiest products. They would often steer homebuyers who could have qualified for conventional government mortgages into riskier loans that put more money in the lenders' pockets, telling buyers they could have a bigger house, or lower payments, or both.
Ross says that even someone like him, a person with real estate industry know-how, even someone like him became a target of the system. And the reason for that, he says, is because the real estate industry has always preyed on Black people.
So when the subprime crisis was developing, why in the hell were we targeted so precisely and systematically for these products? Why in the hell do I, fresh out of college, with an 800 FICO, why do I get pitched on The Secret?
By 2008, Ross says his house was worth half of what he paid. Their mortgage payments were twice what his neighbors were paying to rent homes along his street. So he tried to refinance again and again, but the lenders refused. Because as long as Ross kept paying his mortgage every month, they had no incentive to cut him a better deal.
And I say, oh, I know this game. And that was tough because you have made a commitment. And the commitment is tied in a way to your identity. Like you see yourself as a certain type of person. So we wrestled with that. And I think Tamara and I ultimately decided these people don't give a damn about us. And they are content to bleed us dry. So we ain't gonna pay no more.
So they stopped paying, and Ross knew he and Tamara's credit scores would tank. They would have to swallow that hit for years, he knew that, but he also knew it was the only chance they had to hang on to this house.
Eventually, their gamble worked. A lender finally agreed to help them refinance, and in 2019, Ross was able to sell that house in Fontana. The memories of all of that stress still bring tears to his eyes, but Ross says he considers himself one of the lucky few who made it out, despite a system he thinks is designed to keep Black people on the bottom.
It really makes me sad. Yeah, it makes me sad. Ain't a whole lot of us on this side where we're able to function and kind of take advantage of some of the things that this society has to offer. A lot of us, we don't own property. We don't have equity in the stock market. We don't have equity in this country. We don't own stuff. And ownership is equity.
And that is why Ross isn't wasting his second chance. He's been building a new home nearby, and he recalls a recent conversation with a loan officer who was trying to lock him into a loan now, promising him that if he didn't like the terms, he could always refinance down the road.
And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, this guy is asking me to gamble. And I told him, I said, dude, I said, I'm Black. I said, we've been there, done that. We're going to measure twice and cut once. And we're probably going to keep this house forever. Whether we live in it or not, it's going to belong to our children.
But he says it's not just about leaving behind a house for his children. It's about passing the baton to the next generation and the one after that, so that one day they will have something to call their own. When Billy Ross talks about home ownership and equity, it's worth keeping in mind a few numbers that help put into context the strong ties between home ownership and wealth in America. According to the Federal Reserve, the average homeowner in this country is worth $250,000. The average renter, just $6,000. And yet, the majority of Black households don't own their homes, while nearly three quarters of white households do. This racial gap in home ownership has persisted for generations, even since race-based housing discrimination became illegal. And in this final episode, editor Christopher Intagliata and I examine the financial barriers built into the way we purchase homes in America today. We meet Donnelly Norrington at her house. It's on a quiet, tree-lined street in Compton, south of downtown LA.
So this is the dining room.
A three-bedroom, two-bath set back behind a wide lawn.
And here is the kitchen. Uh-huh. And so we still
it's white with teal trim around the windows.
School. I love it. You have a whole whiteboard here with what, everybody's chores?
Yeah, with everybody's chores and routines and
everybody.
Things of that
That's
nature.
Eight people in total right now. Norrington and her sister Mary Josephine bought this house last June. It's the first house they have ever owned in their names.
Norrington says home ownership always felt like a faraway goal for her.
I didn't even consider home ownership because I just thought it was out of my grasp. Not so much financially, but just the fact that maybe I was too old to own a home and I just didn't want all the responsibility that came with it. And
but then one night she had a dream, like a literal dream.
And God said to me, why don't you get you a mortgage that doesn't move?
Because meaning a fixed rate mortgage. And she says God also told her to seek guidance from someone she already knew.
Also in my dream, it said, go to Mark Alston.
In your dream, you heard the name Mark Alston.
I did, and go to Mark Alston.
Does Mark know that you dreamed of him?
I told him that, you know, during our...
I saw her vision. She started crying before we closed. I told her to wait. Let's get all the way done before we celebrate.
Mark Alston is a mortgage broker. He has mostly black clients in and around Los Angeles.
I mean, it's pretty unbelievable to me. Almost 75% of the white community owns houses. That's an unbelievable figure, really? Three out of every four people have a house? In my community, you know, it's like two out of every 10 in L.A., four out of every 10 in the country.
And Alston says there are systemic reasons for this, layers of barriers. And he has spent his entire real estate career trying to help black Americans break through those barriers so they can achieve the American dream of homeownership and all the generational wealth that comes with it. And Elsa, I spoke with Alston and a bunch of economists to better understand these structural barriers.
Right. So what kind of barriers are we talking about here?
Well, there are four main barriers that I looked into, which make it harder to qualify for a home loan and can make that loan more expensive, especially for the average black American.
Okay, so let's start with the first barrier, qualifying for a loan.
Yeah, Mark says a lot of black clients come to him and they first hit a road bump with their credit score.
Now the wreckage of your past shows up. You're making some good money. You know, you deserve to buy a house, but we've got some credit issues from when you were struggling.
So the average black credit score is 60 points lower than the average white credit score. And also, there are a number of reasons for this, but part of it has to do with higher unemployment rates among African Americans, especially during downturns like we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing Alston and others pointed out to me is that a lot of the regular bills people pay, like cell phone bills and utility bills, even their monthly rent,
which all seem like good indicators of financial responsibility.
Right. None of those payments are included in the typical FICO score that most lenders use.
Which makes it a lot harder to prove you're qualified.
Exactly. So credit scoring, that's the first barrier to just getting your foot in the door. And that brings us to the second barrier, risk-based pricing.
Risk-based pricing. What is that?
So this is the idea that the riskier you are as a borrower, the more I'm going to charge you to lend you money. And about half of black homebuyers get loans backed by the two mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main variables that Fannie and Freddie use to judge risk, they're your credit score and your down payment size.
Okay.
And we already mentioned black Americans have lower average credit scores. Well, black homebuyers, they also tend to make smaller down payments. So you take those two things together, and they get judged as riskier and often end up paying higher prices. Alston has a nickname for this kind of pricing.
The poor pay more fee adjustment. Okay?
Wait, how long has this been going on?
Well, Fannie and Freddie have always done some sort of risk-based pricing, but before the housing crisis, they enabled most homebuyers to access fairly similar rates. And then when crisis hit, Fannie and Freddie tightened their standards and got more aggressive about risk-based pricing, which, as we mentioned, tends to drive up prices for people with less wealth and lower credit scores.
It's inherently unfair that basically we raised the prices during the financial crisis so that people who were hurt by the financial crisis could bail out the financial institutions to enhance the profits of these same financial institutions.
That's MIT economist Ed Golding, who worked at Freddie Mac during the housing crisis, and he says low-wealth, first-time homebuyers today are still being asked to pay more.
It seems that we're asking the victims to pay and to pay again for what was really not their fault.
And Elsa, I should mention, spokespeople for both Fannie and Freddie said this sort of pricing, it helps them manage their risks. And they say it's provided stability during the pandemic and also enabled homeownership for millions of families, including many families of color.
Well, on top of that risk-based pricing, there is still a third barrier, right, that especially holds back Black homebuyers in this country. What is that barrier?
That barrier is mortgage insurance. And this is something you typically have to pay if your down payment is less than 20%. And right now, 9 in 10 Black homebuyers are paying for this, compared to only 6 in 10 white homebuyers.
And buying insurance is basically just another way of making you, the so-called risky homebuyer, pay for this risk.
That's right, yeah.
And we should note, Christopher, that none of the things that we've been talking about so far would be considered discriminatory under the Fair Housing Act, right? Like, lenders are allowed to charge money to absorb what they perceive as risk.
Yeah, yeah. And a free market type person might say, hey, that's just the market pricing risk the way it should be priced. But Golding says it's a choice when we decide to price for risk and when we don't. Take pre-existing conditions, for example.
Right, like in the healthcare market.
Yeah, Golding points out that in that case, we decided not to charge people for being riskier, for having those pre-existing conditions. Instead, we chose to all share that cost.
Right. Okay, well, moving on, let's now take a look at the fourth barrier that a lot of Black home buyers might face.
Yeah, this one looks a lot more like just straight up racial discrimination. These researchers at UC Berkeley did a study for the National Bureau of Economic Research, and after analyzing almost 10 million home loans, they found that Black and Latinx borrowers are still being charged more, even after you control for risk.
Wait, you mean the Black and Latinx home buyers who have the same credit score and put down the same percent down payment as white home buyers, they are still getting charged more?
They're still getting charged more. And this kind of discrimination, it's even built into the computer algorithms that write the loans.
Wow. Wait, but you can't discriminate on the basis of race if you're a lender, right? Like, that's illegal.
It is. It is. And what the courts have said on this up till now is that the only legitimate justification for charging borrowers of one racial group a higher price than another is if it has to do with credit risk. But remember, this study ruled out credit risk as a factor. So something else is going on.
Something like racial discrimination.
Exactly. And Elsa, the result of all those layers we're talking about, which some call a Black tax on homeownership, all those layers mean Black homebuyers are generally paying more to own a home, and therefore they're building less wealth over their lifetimes compared to white homeowners.
How much less wealth?
Well, Ed Golding, remember the MIT economist?
Mm-hmm.
He and his colleagues have done the math, and they say it adds up to tens of thousands of dollars of lost savings and investments over the course of a lifetime.
Wow. Okay, but with the exception of that UC Berkeley study, which shows possible racial discrimination, all of the other barriers we're talking about are things that any home buyer might face, right? Like, why do some experts say this system of home financing is unfair to Black people?
Well, it's interesting, this idea of fair. We brought that up specifically with Mark Alston, the broker, and he has his own take on what fair means in America.
When you've had 350 years of not just unfairness, but actual opposition. You had exclusionary zoning laws, you had federally institutionalized redlining, and now you have disparate housing finance policy. When you have actual opposition, fair is an interesting concept. You know, a good head start beats fast running. If I give you a 350 or 400 year head start, I can never catch you.
We asked Donnelly Norrington about that. It's taken her 60 years to feel like she can even begin to catch up. But when you look at her now, sitting in a lawn chair in her backyard, you can see her marveling at the house that she can finally call her own.
I always feel like a late bloomer, you know. We got our own little piece of land right here, and we don't never have to worry about somebody gonna sell it from up under us or anything like that. And I'm just grateful to God that I had that dream. It was God done this. I don't take no credit. It was God. It was all God. I'm just grateful, you know. I feel really good about that, you know, leaving some sort of legacy. Yeah, that's a really good feeling.
It's a legacy that, to this day, remains out of reach for so many Black Americans.